Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Previously on Car Stuff.
Ah, it's the old Lost open again. Haven't heard that for a while.
Yeah. We have used that trick a time or two when we do a two-parter, right? But don't worry, guys. We're not going to spend an entire episode recapping what happened last episode.
No. In fact, you can just easily go back and find that episode, listen to it. It's not all that long. I think it's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot more to come because this takes, again, a bunch of twists and turns that are you never would have thought that this would come out of driver's ed film.
Right. This is the second part in our series on public safety films inspired by a documentary you and I saw recently called Hell's Highway.
Yeah, Hell's Highway, a little bit to be more specific, I guess. What is it? Hell's Highway, The Truth. Hang on one second. There's a longer title, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
The True Story, Hell's Highway, The True Story of Highway Safety Films.
Yes, made by an Atlanta-based filmmaker. But this, we didn't know this when we first started looking into the documentary.
No.
There's a lot of stuff we didn't know, actually.
Yeah, there's some things that come out today that we'll talk about today that again, twists and turns that you probably wouldn't expect. But can I just do one or two little things before we start?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. So a couple of things have happened since we recorded part one. And I just kind of pull back the curtain here. It's been a while since we've recorded part one.
Yeah.
We typically would walk in the next day or the next session and record part two. However, for whatever reason, scheduling, et cetera, it has been a long time since we recorded part one to part two. And I've got some updated information, some listener feedback already about part one, which I know sounds crazy, but that's the way it works.
It's cool.
So here's another listener that wrote in as a Facebook listener. And wrote in and said that I didn't have, talking about last episode, right? Two days ago.
Yeah.
I just listened to your podcast where you mentioned the highway signs near Chicago that count traffic deaths. I live near at least two of them, and I can tell you that it's an accurate number. We travel by those signs almost daily, and the number slowly grows throughout the year. We noticed that 2014 had fewer deaths than 2013, but 2015 is on track to have a higher count. It's a scary reminder that people die every day on our highways. And that came from a listener named Michael L. out of Chicago or near Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And, I thought, well, that's interesting because we did talk about that when we initially mentioned, I think it was Chris K. Out of Holland, Michigan. He's the one who mentioned that he had driven near these auto-related deaths this year counter in Chicago or just outside of Chicago.
Yeah.
And I had briefly mentioned that I too had seen a counter only here in Georgia, but we don't have a regular counter that stands all the time on the highway.
Right. We don't have like a billboard with a rolling count. We have a number that'll pop up on, you know, LED displays or something.
Yeah, the type of sign that would be over the freeway or the highway that says, accident ahead, two left lanes closed.
Right.
And they can change it. It's switchable.
Yeah.
And we occasionally, on a weekend maybe, we'll get an updated number of Georgia highway fatalities, and the reason they do that is to promote seatbelt safety and safe driving, no distractions, that kind of thing. You know, don't text and drive, that kind of
right,
stuff.
Right, yeah.
Well, I think I mentioned that the count as of, and I got numbers here, the count as of April 27th, 2015 was 400. And we recorded a few days later. We recorded in early May, I believe.
Yes.
All right, so the count was exactly 400 as of April 27th. So here's what I did, Ben. We're recording today, and I'll just tell you what day we're recording the day this releases. We're recording
right
on May 14th. And I kind of counted the days of the year, and I did a bunch of math. So do you want to hear a little bit of this and see if it makes sense?
Yeah, walk me through it.
The only way I can get an updated number for today is like a projected number. So I had to kind of do this process, and we'll see if this works out right.
Okay.
So I determined that April 27th was the 117th day of the year. And I had read a stat somewhere that said that on average, this is a terrible stat, by the way. On average, the DOT says that we lose three lives on Georgia highways every day, every single day of the year.
Wow.
So that's an average of three deaths a day. Now, of course, we were at more than 400. And if you take 117 times three, it only equals 351. They said we're something like, and this is ballpark, they said they're about 25% ahead of this year, like as far as death tolls go, or death count goes. And it sounds like Chicago is doing the same thing. They're up from previous years. By the way, that's a reversal of a 9-year trend here in Georgia.
I thought deaths were declining.
Yeah, for the last 9 years, they've been going down, down, down. And this year, we're 25% ahead of where we should be, according to the stats.
And that might still even out as the year progresses.
It's not likely, though. But it really is not likely. And there's some reasons that I can talk about in just a second, because that's the second part of this. And then we're going to get right back into the stuff, I promise.
Because
I felt this is necessary. So today we're 17 days later from the day that I saw that, not the day we recorded, but the day I saw it. So it is officially the 134th day of the year here. And if you calculate in that average of 3 per day, which, by the way, we're not exactly meeting up with, so it's probably more. If you average that, or you count in that 3 per day that we're, we add another 51 lives lost on Georgia highways since I last reported that number 41. But if you want to increase that, so we're looking at a realistic number of about 451 already.
Wow.
That's between episode 1 and episode 2. It's up to 451. Now, if you add in 25%, which includes 13 more lives lost, we could be, and I don't know if this is accurate or not, we could be at 464 lives lost on Georgia highways as of today, if all these numbers play out correctly.
That's frightening stuff, and I'm glad that you brought it to the air, because one of the things that we were talking about previously was the great argument of whether the ends justify the means, right? And one thing we saw happen several times in the course of the Hell's Highway documentary would be these people who were saying, well, yes, it is violent, and yes, it is disturbing, but I think it's worth it because we saved people's lives.
Ah, yes. Now, this goes to the whole argument of why we're even talking mm-hmm. about this, why we're even bringing this up today, and why that documentary was created. Does it take something this strong? Does it take something, does it take seeing a tragedy like this, actually witnessing a real-life tragedy, a real-life death on the highway over and over and over again to get through to a teen driver that this is real, that this is something that can happen to you, even though everyone in those films say it can't happen to me. They said that at some point.
Right.
Or they had that thought. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't happen to me. And then it did. And so the other teens that are, left watching these films in Driver's Ed or whatever,
sure.
They've probably got the same idea, but now they've got a visual, something visual to relate to say, I've seen it happen. Maybe I'll adjust my driving habits. Maybe I'll buckle my seatbelt, whereas I wouldn't have in the past.
Because, right.
Again, seatbelts were an option in a lot of cars at that
yeah.
point. Safety glass was, in fact, used, but it wasn't used in every vehicle at that point, I don't think. I want to say it was like the 1920s when laminated glass kind of came around and people were starting to use them. But I think Ford mandated safety glass in his cars after a big lawsuit.
Yeah.
He did not have it prior to that. And let's see, seatbelts. I mean, seatbelts go back to 1885 for the patent.
Uh-huh.
But, you're still getting into like the 1950s before there were even options in some cars. And then get this, the world's first seatbelt law, like where they said you have to wear your seatbelt when you're driving, when cars
mm-hmm.
in motion,
mm-hmm.
1970. It wasn't
wow.
until 1970. And okay.
And let's keep in mind, too, not all seatbelts are created equal, because that thing invented in the late 1800s is more like a lap belt than the three-point harness
Absolutely.
That we have now.
Yeah, yeah. The three-point harness, I want to say that was in 1955 was when it was developed or patented.
Niels Bohlen, no relation.
Really?
Yeah. The name is spelled differently. Sadly, we are not related. I would love to be related to Niels Bohlen, because his invention or his patent of the seatbelt is estimated to have saved over a billion lives.
Wow. Amazing. And you would be a trust fund baby right now.
I totally would. Yeah.
That's
are you
right.
kidding?
Yeah, that's a huge, huge advancement in safety. So, yeah, you're right. It's a big deal. But, 1955 and then all these films we see, I mean, the lap belts are still optional equipment
right.
in some cars.
Right.
The three-point belt wasn't going to be seen in production vehicles for some time.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't. It's slow to adopt and slow to catch on. So there's stuff out there right now that, we're slow to adopt even.
Sure. Yeah. There were no crumple zones, for instance.
Yeah. I mean, and we're already looking at things like, pedestrian airbags and, crazy stuff that, they had no thought of in 1955. But anyways, I'm getting way off track already. We've got a couple of other quick things I'd like to mention. That does bring about, though, one thought, and I have a question for you before I get back to the DOT
okay.
stuff and then into the films.
Right.
Man. Sorry, Ben. getting into a lot of stuff here.
Are you kidding? This is interesting.
So when I hear, you know, these seatbelt numbers, and we're talking about seatbelts, does this remind you of any maybe relatives, and without naming names,
okay,
any relatives that you may have had in the past? Because you and I grew up, I was a little earlier than you, but not much.
Yeah.
And there were some relatives that just refused to wear seatbelts.
Oh.
Even when they were mandatory, even when it was a law, and of course they were installed in the car.
Right. Yeah. Anybody? I had a few. just one or two that I specifically recall not bothering with it. One, and again, I'll play by the rules here and not name names in case anybody in my family is listening. Mm-hmm. One of my relatives had the best reason ever. He was elderly, and he said, well, you know, I'm at that point now where I've lived. That was his answer.
And, oh boy. So he's got the, it's been a good run.
Yeah, he very much did. But man, he was, the boat that he was driving was, you know, gigantic. Sure. I don't know how he pulled it off. He also drove like a madman. And interestingly enough, in Georgia, this guy didn't live in Georgia, but in Georgia for a long time, there was a seatbelt exception. Do you remember this?
No.
One of the representatives didn't want to wear a seatbelt, and so for a long time, you didn't have to wear a seatbelt in a pickup truck.
No kidding.
Because he drove a pickup truck.
What? I actually do remember this. This wasn't that long ago.
No, not very much.
I mean, we're talking like I've only lived here since 2008 in Georgia. It was just finally, I think, they made seatbelts mandatory in pickups very recently since then.
Yeah.
So this is brand new, or not brand new, but recent.
But what about you? You got seatbelt refusers?
I do. My grandfather and my... I can say it. He's passed away, but not from this. But a long time ago, I remember riding in a car with him, or several cars with him. He died when I was very young, but he just did not like the feel of the shoulder belt part of a seatbelt. He would wear the lap belt part.
Okay.
So he would buckle that, and then he would take the shoulder belt part. You know how you can extend it way out?
Right, and just loop it behind him or
no,
something?
No, he would. It was the weirdest thing. He would hold it with his, let's say he's in the passenger side. He would take his right hand, extend it all the way out towards the dash, and hold it out at arm's length away from his body. And then he would ride like that.
Why?
I don't know, but he would wear that lap belt like that. You know, that was important, but he didn't like the feel of it across his chest and his shoulder. I don't know what it was, a restriction thing. But and I also have, I can't say who this is right now, but
okay.
It's someone in another state, but they refuse to wear a seatbelt. Will not wear a seatbelt, and here's the reasoning. And I think I may have said this on another podcast. The reasoning is that he heard one or two stories where the person in a really horrific crash survived due to the fact that they were thrown from the vehicle. That they didn't stay in the vehicle. Now, this is a horrible argument for a lot of reasons, because that means that you've been thrown through the windshield, out the side window.
And somehow didn't hit anything.
Or have somebody hit you afterwards.
Right.
Landing. You know, just how does your body get out there? That's violent, violent wreck.
Right.
And today's vehicles, I mean, you can make this argument all day long. They have so many other things going for them, airbags and the safety structures that are built around, and, you know, all the pre-tensioners and the seatbelts and all that.
Sure.
It's far safer to be in the vehicle during the accident than it is to be thrown free from the vehicle. I know there's that one in a billion chance that that's the one that survives, but typically if you're thrown out, you're dead.
And that's such a selection bias too. It's such a common trait of a lot of people, myself included, to look for things that already confirm our pre-existing belief, right?
Sure. Yeah. It's in your corner.
Right.
Yeah.
So that one time somebody survives out of the hundreds of times people have been launched through windshields, I don't think that's a decent argument.
It is not a decent argument, I'll tell you. And the ones that we're going to talk about in just a minute, because I've got one more little bit. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And
it all
ties together with the seatbelts thing. The ones that we see in these films, a common factor among all of them, not every single one, but most of them, is that they weren't belted in. Even in the 1950s, 1960s,
right,
the lap belts, you know, they didn't have the airbags. They had, you know, pointy things that were on the dash that were facing them, you know, that kind of stuff that was just it was a far different era as far as car design goes and the thought process behind what happens during the accident.
Well, there were also some urban legends, too, that wearing a seatbelt would raise your chances of decapitation, for instance.
Yeah, and, you know, that kind of stuff played into people's consciousness, and they maybe didn't choose to do that. And it was relatively new. Some people had started driving without lap belts available even.
Uh-huh.
Or they got in a car that didn't, you know, like younger teens maybe got in a car that their dad owned that didn't have one, but then they got a new car later and it did have one, and they weren't accustomed to put it on, and they didn't have to. It wasn't a rule. It wasn't a law.
Yeah, so there wasn't any seatbelt indicator that came on with the little beep, beep, beep.
No, there was none
beep.
Of that. It was there, and oftentimes it would just be tucked, you know, tucked into the seat, and,
right.
and everybody forgot about it. So the last thing before we jump into the films again,
uh-huh.
where we were last episode, and sorry, all this, I've been digging through this. This topic is so fascinating to me that I could go on all day about the other stuff. I found some models of cars that have been death-proof for about 9 years, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, we'll talk about that in another episode, but because we're running out of time. So I'll finish with some brand new information from the Georgia DOT. And this was, you know, when I was trying to look up the current death toll numbers, which are unavailable to me right now. All this stuff about 25%, et cetera, that came from this document. If you skip down lower here, it says that there's a reason that they're up 25%, and they know the trends. They can say, I don't know exactly why. But there's a trend that we're seeing, and it's probably something that you would expect. It's distracted driving.
Yes.
This is huge. Now, it's always been a problem, distracted driving,
sure.
but for different reasons. You know, like maybe having a cheeseburger when you're behind the wheel, or maybe talking to the kids in the back seat with a roughhousing or whatever, stuff like that.
But now the widespread use of phones in cars, which some studies argue is similar to driving under the influence of alcohol or a drug, that's got to be what's boosting the trend.
Sure, it delays your reaction time. So they say that a guy named Captain Alan Marlowe with the Georgia State Patrol, and he says that our big three ones, meaning the traditional top three killers on our highways, our original big three have historically been impaired driving, whether it's alcohol or drugs. The second is occupant protection, meaning child safety seats and seat belts. That's a big one. So seat belts again.
Uh-huh.
And the third is speed. I mean, it's always been there. Now we're starting to see distracted driving emerge as a new contributor to this overall death toll. And just how big of a factor is this? Well, and how do they know this? Well, so far this year, this is a crazy number, only 38% of victims in fatality crashes were wearing their seatbelts. That means that in fatal accidents, 62% of victims were not wearing a seatbelt. That means that, you know, the argument from someone that I know is it totally invalid. So, okay. And 60%, and here we go with the distracted driving part, 60% of the fatalities were from single vehicle crashes, and that means like hitting a tree or a bridge, things like that. So these are people on their own in the car, and they just, for some reason, veer off the road. Now, what do you think that reason is? I mean, they're all alone, they've got their phone in their hand or on their seatbelt, or on their seat next to them, rather. Most of them aren't wearing their seatbelt, which is, again, horrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty clear what's going on here.
Let me point something out too. This is a little bit of a tangent, but then we'll get to the film, because that statistic is fascinating. I've been thinking about stuff like this a lot, Scott. You know, while I'm at the intersection on my phone.
oh, Ben, I hope not.
No.
Okay.
I'm joking. But there are some great and frankly disturbing studies about how having a phone with you all the time can affect your brain activity and your behavior, your habits, because you get this little rush of dopamine that feels good every time you update something on your phone. So for those of you on Facebook or Twitter, first off, join us at CarStuffHSW.
But not in your car.
And secondly, keep a track of how many times you check your phone every hour.
Yeah, just it'd be interesting to find that or figure that out. Also, some people this isn't everybody, I understand, but some people simply cannot ignore that alert. When they hear the buzz, they hear the little tone, they feel compelled. They have to pick it up and see what's going on. And I'm not one of those people. I can have it in my pocket and feel it buzz or whatever, and I won't look at it until I get home. Even if it's 45, if I know it's going to be 45 minutes later, I still won't even peek at it.
Yeah, the opposite of a lot of people.
No, I think there's a good number of people out there that still can, that still are like that. Others, I know that, like, if it's on the table across the room, they have to run over to see what's happening or what's going on. My kid is like that, unfortunately. She's about 13 now, and I'm hoping to kind of, you know, to tell her why that's a bad idea or why that's not so great, you know, to be so distracted. Even when she's not driving yet.
Right.
But I could see that being a problem when the driving age arrives.
Well, let me further the argument here, Scott, because there are two parts to this. The first is that everybody, regardless of their age, with access to a cell phone. There are also dopamine experiments with rodents that indicate the same thing. Mm-hmm. Your likelihood of needing to constantly update to get that little dopamine rush can have some serious long-term effects in terms of both your reading ability, like the ability to read a long article without going to, Tumblr or... What's another one people use?
Instagram.
Oh, Instagram. Yeah, my girlfriend loves Instagram, mm-hmm. and I'm terrified of it. I don't like the idea.
So my kid's an addict, is what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that there's not just your kid, but anybody, and to a degree, you and I and our coworkers as well. Once we teach our brains to expect that little shot of dopamine all the time, then there is something kind of like addiction. I wouldn't go so far as to call it that because I'm not an expert, but there's a habituation. So here's the second part. And this is why this kind of is a segue for us with the film, because you and I have talked before about the driving age, which is controversial. And here in the U.S., it goes state by state. In some areas, you can have a license at a much younger age because, frankly, you need it to work on a farm, mm-hmm. right? Or you need it to transport something between very long distances. So what we have found, we being scientists, who probably I shouldn't include myself in the number, but what experts have found is that the teenage brain is still developing. You don't hop in a car and become a grown woman or a grown man when you're 15, 16. What occurs instead is that your brain is still evolving its ability to control impulse, right? To make deferred gratification decisions, to even do some spatial calculations. And my concern is that growing up with an exposure, because kids are getting cell phones younger and younger and younger,
yeah.
and Facebook accounts younger and younger and younger, and they're getting that dopamine rush or that habit of dopamine younger and younger and younger. And how does this affect a brain that is still developing in terms of decisions? I don't know. I'm not saying that the driving age should be raised to like 47 or something, but
there's some arguments that that it should maybe be pushed a little bit later.
Yeah, there are some compelling arguments that it should be. And one of the things that we see is, despite all the massive safety precautions and regulations innovations really that the manufacturers and advocacy groups and Uncle Sam have put on the road, we're still seeing a rise in deaths because now none of these safety regulations so far will solve the problem of somebody playing on their phone while they're going 70 miles an hour down the interstate.
That's true. Okay, and now we're talking about a world where we have airbags, we have side impact beams and doors.
Sure, yeah.
We have, of course, laminated safety glass. We have...
We have crash collision predictors.
We have seats that that react in a way, whether you're hitting the front or in the mm-hmm. rear, they react so that they minimize spinal cord damage. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of so many safety innovations, but let's go back to 1959.
Yes,
where really none of that was involved. I mean, I've said it a few times in the other podcast, I remember, but the steering column was a spear. And it really was. And
it stake through the chest.
It wasn't collapsible, so you could hit in the front end, and that steering column was coming right at your chest. And not only that, but I mean, the dashboards were solid metal with lots of gauges and instruments,
right?
And
stylish
dials
clocks.
And, yeah, metal that protruded out that was pointing towards the mm-hmm. driver and passenger. Mm-hmm. You combine that with seatbelts that were either non-existent or there but optional, and oftentimes even in the optional vehicles that they were equipped, not used. Not every time, but most of the time, you had people that just they. Frankly, they had never seen anything. Like, they hadn't seen these horrific accidents before, unless they had, happened across one, or they knew somebody that was, involved in something like that. But they didn't really see it. Now, we see a lot of things on television today. We see a lot of, whether it's real or it's dramatized,
Right.
Everybody's got a cell phone. So they snap photos of every accident that, where they pass by. Rubberneckers, they might grab a quick video. And that stuff makes itself on, it makes itself available online. You know, the person who took it uploads it immediately.
Instantly.
And then, you know, maybe it'll get pulled down. Maybe it won't. Maybe it'll live around for a while or hang around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But we see some horrific things. Back in the 1950s, 1960s, it was, you just didn't see that. There wasn't the internet. There wasn't a place to go and see something like that. It was like a horror show.
Yeah.
I mean, it really was. These films were like scary movies, but more than they'd ever seen. Cause, you know, I don't know what films I can compare this to, but I mean, they were watching films like, you know, the Swamp Thing and stuff
right.
like that.
Right,
Creature
from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, and I know I've got the titles wrong. I'm just making stuff up right now. But they were scary films, like The Blob or whatever.
Yeah,
but they
yeah.
were like that. They weren't like the blood and gore films that we like, see today.
They weren't like Texas Chainsaw Massacre
or like
Faces of Death.
Hostel or something like that.
Yeah.
It was just over the top, you know,
right.
just gore, blood and gore. You didn't see that kind of thing back then. So these films... for a lot of kids were just so shocking, so stark, such a an incredible reality for them to take in all at one time in a classroom situation with their friends all around them.
Right.
And they really weren't expecting it. I mean, initially they weren't expecting it. So the first one that we had and the one we left off on was Signal 30.
Yeah, Signal 30.
Yeah, and this was, again, the radio traffic code for at least for the Ohio State Highway Patrol. It was the radio code for a traffic fatality,
mm-hmm.
and this was the first film that was made by the Highway Traffic Safety, or what am I thinking of?
By the Highway Safety Foundation.
Highway Safety Foundation, yeah, because they do change names a couple times.
Right.
It goes from Highway Safety Foundation to the Highway Safety Films, Inc., and then later, I think it stayed the same name later, but much, much less less production coming out of that.
Right. Signal 30, this was in 1959,
mm-hmm.
And so they were still the Highway Safety Foundation. And this is one that has stayed in the public sphere. I think recently, you remember that show Mad Men?
Yes.
Did you ever watch that?
I have not. No, I'm not a Mad Men fan.
I haven't watched either. There's an episode of Mad Men called Signal 30 that has a...
And it's about Signal 30, this film?
I don't think so. I don't know. I haven't seen it. But,
oh, okay.
But it's an episode of that TV show. It's still around.
Mm.
What's the fancy word? The zeitgeist?
Yeah, I will have to look into it, because I bet you know what? I bet it references it in some way, because why else would it be named Signal 30?
Right,
it's
yeah.
set in that era, so I would see that that happening.
So Signal 30, just so everybody knows, graphic, gruesome, and it won the National Safety Council Award.
And... this is the biggest part. Real. It was
yes.
real. It was all real. The fatalities, the people screaming, the agony, the pain,
yeah.
the scenes that they came across, you know, that we talked about with, and who are our players here? Richard Wyman, Reagan. Phyllis Vaughn, her sister, Dottie Deems, who was also Dottie Vaughn at the
yeah,
time.
That was a photographer, and Wayne Byers is the infamous narrator.
Yeah, that's right. And then Earl Deems, who is a photographer as well. He's a cameraman.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, John Butler. So those are names that we're going to refer to. John Butler was the former chief of police for the Ohio State Safety – or Highway Patrol, rather, back during the time when Wayman was around and was producing Signal 30. So Signal 30 came out. It's a 16-millimeter film. And it was unlike anything driver's ed students had ever seen before.
Yeah.
Unlike anything the Highway State Patrol had ever seen before. It was groundbreaking, really.
Right. And it kind of, I think we might have mentioned this in the earlier podcast, Scott, but there was precedent for this kind of scare 'em straight film.
Mm-hmm.
And it borrowed a lot from military films for young GIs going out in the field.
Yeah, and industrial films.
Yes.
For accident prevention. Because
right.
the insurance companies and who else? I think it's mostly insurance companies were trying to save lives on the job because it cost them. That's why.
Right. And here's just an example of the narration. Because we're an audio podcast, of course, we're not going to show you clips of the film, but you can find them readily available online. Be warned, though, don't eat before you do it. I've got one of the lines here.
Okay.
You want to hear it?
Mm-hmm.
Now comes the nauseating task of removing the shattered hulk of a life that had been lived so little. Lines like that, the entire narration mm-hmm. is that way.
Yeah, and very very dry, very very monotone, without any kind of emotion at all. I mean, that was the thing with these things, is that it had a very creepy feel to them. They all did.
You know,
the music, everything.
Yeah. Someone told me... Who was I watching this with? One of my friends, I kind of tricked them into doing some research with me.
Really?
Yeah, we were hanging out, and it's like, oh, you got to see this.
Yeah.
And I still think he's probably not cool about it because it's very graphic, but he thought it was an episode of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know.
Yeah, you could definitely shock some friends with this. Now, one thing, you know what? I think we should mention the ambulance thing right now.
Because oh, yes,
This is an important part of this, and I'll tell you, I've watched some of these films. I've watched some, not all of them. I've watched some of them. I think Highway Safety Films produced something like 14 films, not all about traffic safety, but most of them.
Right.
There were copycats, so there's a lot of films out there.
And the ambulance thing is one of the first things we wanted to get to in this.
Yeah, this is amazing. Now, thinking back, how many years now? We're talking almost 60 years ago, right? Is that right?
I mean,
yeah, 60, almost 60
yeah,
years.
Almost
okay,
60.
So almost 60 at this point. You've got to realize that the ambulance drivers were not EMTs like they are today. It's not the same idea. The whole process is completely different. The EMT thing, I mean, I don't know if you can call it that, but the EMT program even didn't come about until like the early 1970s. So the people that ran the ambulances were the people that also ran the funeral parlor and home. The ambulance was the hearse was the ambulance, one and the same. And the staff from the funeral home, I don't know how they would rotate this, this duty, but they would be the ones that would come out and gather up the victims and either take them to the morgue or take them to the hospital, whichever was necessary. But they're not EMTs, and that's essential because they're not trained medical professionals. At this point in history, they don't really know how to handle somebody who's got a serious spine injury or somebody who has a leg that, you know, the bone is sticking through.
Or someone who's bleeding out.
Yeah, somebody who is, you know, internal bleeding. They don't know that there's a rush to get they don't even know probably that they have internal bleeding. It's crazy to see what's happening because when they arrive, you know, they may have a uniform on of some kind. You know, they arrive in one of these old school Cadillac, hearse limo type vehicles, which is really cool, by the way. They look really neat.
They do.
But then when they get out and they handle the victims, it's as if, okay, so someone's laying on the ground with a sore back and neck, you know, from this terrible injury, they're bleeding. They'll pick them up like you or I would pick them up, Ben, like out on a football field or something like, and we probably wouldn't even do that now.
Yeah, like one on each end.
Yeah, like one on the feet and one on the shoulders. And they haul them up, you know, they kind of like heave-ho them onto a gurney and push them in and that's it.
And you can see this on some of these films.
And it's not that, it will be shocking to you when you see the way they handle them, but it's not that they didn't intend to hurt them or anything.
Right.
It's just they didn't know better at this point. They didn't know how to stabilize the spine before they do it. And, you know, all the processes that we have now with EMTs, they do it correctly, but that wasn't known for another 20 years.
Yeah, they need to – EMTs now, of course, one of the first things you do is you assess the condition. But when these guys were coming out, if the person was dead, they took them to the morgue and did a, started a late night of work. But if they were alive, then it was just a race to get them to the hospital before they died.
And this leads to another thing. And this is quick here in the whole process. But you may wonder, how did they get to all these scenes when they did? How were they able to get to the scene of a fatal accident at 3 a.m. on a Friday night? Before the ambulance arrives, how are they there to see the ambulance arrive?
Oh, you're talking about the Highway Safety Foundation.
Yeah. So you think, well, okay, this guy named Earl Deems, who we see interviewed in Hell's Highway, the documentary. Mm-hmm. How did he get there on time? Well, here he told the story of how it all works, and he said, of course, all the appropriate calls were made from the Highway State Patrol, and they're working with them. They're working carefully with them. You know, Butler, I guess, said to Wyman, "Yeah, we'll cooperate because we think it's an important message. We want it out there." So. They would, the accident call would come into the police station, and maybe this is off a little bit, but the appropriate calls would be made. Like he would contact, you know, the officers to get out there to take care of the scene.
Right.
He would contact, the ambulance company / funeral home, to get out there as well. And then the final call, you know, whether there was another call to be made or not, I'm not sure, but the very last call would be to Wyman's group, to the people that were filming for this series of Driver's Ed films. They had the priorities of getting everybody out there that they normally would, then the film crew. And so when he would call the film crew, this Earl guy said, you know, he would call me at about, you know, it might be in the middle of the night on Saturday, and, you know, like 2 a.m., and he'd say, we've got a fatality out on Interstate whatever out in, near Mansfield.
Yeah.
And he said, at that time when I was young, I could be, and this guy's like 80 years old at this point. He said, when I was young, he said, I could get dressed in, you know, a minute and a half and be out the door with my gear ready to go. And so he said, I knew that I was the last call, so I knew that everybody was on their way there, or at least would be. I knew that I could probably get dressed faster than the funeral home guys and get things together and ready to go. So he said, and he said it, you know, sort of gently, but he said, if I raced to the scene, and he knew that was, you know, not the right way to say it, because it's going to a traffic fatality, but if he would get to the scene as fast as he could, he had a good chance of seeing kind of the raw scene of what was going on, of what was happening when the officers were there and he was there and that was it. No one else.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know. It's tough when you think about it, because it would be terrible for someone to die in a car accident on the way to try to save somebody in a car accident or take photos of them. And you can, you know, you can imagine, I'm sure, ladies and gentlemen, you can imagine how there might be tension between the ambulance, the EMTs, and some of the, maybe some of the police force too, because these people aren't helping. They're just taking photos.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I mean, you just said EMTs, and there really weren't any EMTs.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So those guys, I mean, the ambulance drivers and the funeral directors or whoever they were that were out there, I don't know if there was that kind of tension between them, because those guys, I mean, sure, they're there to help and they know that they're there to get the victims out, but I don't think that they had the urgency that EMTs do now, because that's their purpose, to be there, is to stabilize the situation, I know that they would be angry if they saw someone standing around doing nothing, of course, but also you don't want to interfere and harm somebody. Back then it was a little different. I mean, it was like, maybe the film crew knew more about securing an accident victim or stabilizing an accident victim than the funeral home guys did, because they saw it over and over and over again.
That's a good point.
Maybe even more than, you know, one individual group had been out to a scene before. I don't know.
There is also one different thing.
I'm spitballing all this. I don't really know.
I've got one different thing that we definitely should say, which is that of the highway safety photographers, Dick Wayman himself would just hang out at the police station, possibly because that was the best way to get the first call.
Yeah, because then he, without any conscience, could call his guy and say, get out there right now. And he's making that same call, that phone call at the same time as they're calling for police backup and for the ambulance. So, that's probably not a bad theory, because he would be there often. He was there. I don't know.
I don't want to say hanger on, but
yeah, no,
he's part of the entourage.
He was a police booster.
Yes,
maybe that's
yeah,
the way to
yeah,
say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that he was really into law enforcement, and again, this is kind of a vicarious way for him to get that excitement.
For sure, yeah. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, nothing wrong with that, but it paid off for him in the end, rather. Okay, so here's the thing. So that, you know, authenticity is really big for these filmmakers.
Right.
And of course they're getting that by going to these scenes, but oftentimes they would like to maybe just, instead of just being shot after shot of gore and blood and guts and, the dry narration of what's going on, they would maybe like to do, like a little reenactment beforehand, like what led to this accident. Because, you know, there were surviving victims, not all the time, but they could talk to them and find out what happened the day of that, you know, what led to this horrible accident. And so here's what they would do. And this plays into the whole genre of film, I guess, is that oftentimes the reenactments were very poorly acted. And there's a good reason for that. And a lot of people feel that maybe, the recreations we're talking about were poorly acted. And they say that, you know, that might actually play into the way that this whole thing feels. It doesn't feel polished. It doesn't feel Hollywood. It feels very gritty and very real.
Yeah, there's a visceral nature to it.
Yeah, and the reason behind this is because the actors were often local amateur actors or just locals that they picked up at a truck stop down the road.
Yeah, or actual law enforcement.
Yeah, that's true. Law enforcement as well. But they're not actors. They're people who are just asked for the day to play a role, and here's what we're wanting you to do. I don't have any idea if they're paid or if they're doing it simply for the fame of being in one of these films or whatever, but you'll see a lot of stiff acting, a lot of poor acting. But again, people think that kind of plays into this very amateurish feel, which gives it even another level of kind of creepiness to it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's
definitely another level of creepiness.
Yeah, it's just gritty, it's real, it's raw. And that's the way the whole thing feels from start to finish.
And it offsets the actual footage of the accidents and the deaths.
And as Earl Deem said, he said, when we were shooting those reenactments, we were having a lot of fun, because you know, we're dealing with people that, you know, are kind of excited about being in front of the camera.
Right.
You know, we're having a good day out, you know, on the highways or whatever, just taping whatever we're doing. It's fun to go on a video shoot or film shoot, right?
Sure.
And he said oftentimes we got to crash a car, you know, like they would crash. They would buy another car that looks similar to the one that was in the accident. And they would get to crash that car. And he said that was a lot of fun, of course. But when they were filming the real stuff, that was horrific. That was in no way fun. We didn't enjoy that at all. In fact, they said, well, how did you even deal with that? How did you handle what you were seeing? Because you're seeing the worst of the worst here, you know, every week, every day sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I and other camera operators got to the point where we didn't really take in, we didn't really internalize what we had seen through the lens until we got back to the studio and we were reviewing our footage. When we were looking at the film that we had shot, you know, maybe two or three nights before, mm-hmm. in the middle of the week, we just didn't understand, like, oh man, I just didn't see what I was capturing there until this very moment. And it's heartbreaking. And they said it was causing a lot of mental issues with them, like,
right.
Like
PTSD.
Yeah, exactly right. Like, you know, how do I handle this? But, you know, again, he had this kind of this is my job, and then later I can think about what I'm doing. There were times when he had difficulty or trouble recounting what had happened 45 years ago. I mean, scenes that he had
right.
witnessed through the lens 45 years ago were causing this 80-year-old man to cry.
And this is not a milquetoast. Like, this guy is a hard case.
Yeah, he was. He was, I mean, again, he's lived his life, you know,
right.
he's seen a lot. And thinking back 45 years ago, what he had seen on the highways in Ohio was causing him to you know, become emotional.
Right.
And rightfully so. I mean, there's a lot to it. I mean, there's some, you know, specific moments that he points to, and I won't, you know, give it away or anything.
Sure.
Leave something for them to watch in the documentary, but.
Signal 30 had two sequels as well.
Okay.
I should probably mention those.
Yeah.
It had Mechanized Death, which was even more gruesome than Signal 30.
If you can believe it.
Yeah, believe it or not, folks. And then there is Wheels of Tragedy in 1963. But although these were the first, these were the legitimate sequels, this spawned a sort of genre because there would be other knockoffs, right? There would be like Red Asphalt, Highways of Agony, and these other filmmakers, and Wayman as well, were upping the stakes each time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was becoming increasingly more aggressive in terms of the gore. I would say a little bit more formulaic too. We talked a little bit about how radically different this became from so many other social guidance films, right? Because I think we mentioned there used to be, in a lot of these, there used to be one person who's doing everything right, you know, like Little Susie Perfect, right? And then there's Sammy Terrible. I don't know. I'm
Johnny Do and Johnny Don't.
Perfect. Johnny Do and Johnny Don't. But there is no Johnny Do in these. There is at best a police officer warning you of the consequences, and you kind of are just waiting for the blood and the accident to occur whenever you start these films. And I imagine, you know, Scott, look, some of my friends right now are in their, you know, in their mid to late 30s or something and are still terrified of seeing blood. They are terrified of seeing blood. One of them told me it's because she saw films like this when she was really young.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, like, you know, some of the kids that you'd be talking about, they saw some of the films that were probably produced in the 70s, 80s, maybe even the 90s.
Which means there's a big, big difference, right?
That's right. In the 1970s, a big change comes about. So, you know, these started in about 1959. That was Signal 30.
Uh-huh.
It went all through the 1960s. And then in the 1970s, things got a little bit different. They softened up a bit, I guess, mm-hmm. on the idea behind these intense classroom movies for driver's ed. And here's the explanation from the documentary is that there was a heavy feminist influence in the classroom in the 1970s. Now, I know that some people are going to say that's probably not the case or whatever, but
right.
I'd love to talk to our Stuff Mom Never Told You.
Oh yeah, Kristen and Caroline.
Yeah, Kristen and Caroline, see what they think about this. And maybe we'll talk about this at some point with them
sure.
out in the office, but they said that it was kind of a move away from this male violence culture, I guess, that had kind of been prevalent up until this point. They said, we need to maybe think about the kids' feelings a little bit more. We need to say that, you know, see that these things for what they are, and they're vulgar, and they're even abusive to kids, is what they said.
Right, and do they save lives, too, was one of the questions.
Yeah, well, sure, that's always the question. That's been the question all along, is do they save lives? Do they really work? Well, it turns out that, you know, some parents, of course, were vehemently opposed to them showing these films to their kids, because remember we said 12 years old up to about, you know, driving age, 15,
sure,
16.
Sure, sure.
12, let's just get this out there. 12 is way too young. I mean, if you're showing it to a 15 or 16-year-old, understandable, but shocking still, yes. Damaging to them, possibly. I mean, there's a lot of different ways we can argue this back and forth, but 12 years old, I think we can all agree, is way too young to see something like this.
Right. Oh, can we go back to the 60s, though?
Oh, we definitely will, but I just want to say that in the 1970s, like the switchover, what they did was they, instead of going completely, you know, cold turkey that we're not going to even have these films anymore, they switched over to a different type of safety film for driver's ed, and it was more like we're going to show you crash footage with crash test dummies, and we're going to show you, we're going to tell you, you know, some of the more, you know, the technology that's out there to help prevent stuff like this from happening. You know, like if you wear your seatbelt,
right,
that's going to help. But we have collapsible steering columns now, that's going to help. We we use padded dashes in cars now, that helps as well. But you should still wear your seatbelt. And also don't put your arms out the window when you're driving, because that's a bad idea. So things like that. It was more crash test footage, and it was just a softer way to look at something like this. So that was what happened in the 1970s. But going back to the 1960s, again, still in this brutal film time.
Right, yeah. And there's a heyday for these brutal films in the 60s. As I think we had mentioned before, engine innovation was outpacing safety innovation. Mm-hmm. And that's really one of the big key factors here from a technological perspective. From a social perspective, something else happened that a lot of people weren't expecting. In 1965, a guy some of you may remember named Ralph Nader, who we've mentioned before on this podcast.
Sure.
He was doing a lot of consumer advocacy type stuff, and he published a book called Unsafe at Any Speed, which has also made an appearance on our show, right?
Yes.
And there was an entire chapter here on the Chevy Corvair, which he called a one-car accident. Mm-hmm. And Nader was alleging that U.S. automakers were, I guess, trying to pinch a penny or save a buck by skimping on safety stuff, but this really caught a lot of interest, and he created this book in part because of this, I mean, should we call it like an epidemic of accidents?
I don't know if you can call it an epidemic.
I don't know if it was far enough to be an epidemic, but it was, there were definitely a lot. Let's be honest, people did not read that. It wasn't on, you know, bestsellers outside of Washington and Detroit, maybe.
Probably.
But I think these films and the book and then the congressional hearings that happened afterwards were all related.
Sure, and they all raised public awareness. I mean, it becomes front page news.
Right.
And that's the thing, is that, you know, it pushes that agenda even further into people's lives, so that more people see it and more people are talking about it with friends, and then more people see it, and it just snowballs from that point.
Right, and it went all the way up to Congress, as we said, and Dick Wayman was one of the people lobbying Congress for these safety innovations. So I think it's very easy for maybe the casual observer to just say, well, this Dick Wayman guy or Richard Wayman guy is a creep who likes taking photographs of violent things.
Yeah.
But that's not all he did. He did try to become an advocate.
Yeah. In fact, yeah, he lobbied for seatbelt usage and other safety features. And as I think John Butler will point that out later in the documentary.
Yes.
But the thing about these films is that, you know, they were real. They were true. Honest to goodness, this is what happens when you don't wear your seatbelt. This is what happens when you drink and drive. They're very honest about what happens, and it's like a stark reality that they put out in front of the teens that were just about to get behind the wheel of the car for the first time, or maybe had just started driving. And when they see it like that, you know, the kids have to take notice. They have to realize, like, well, this could happen to me.
Yeah.
So some people I know would, it probably did change a few teen driving habits, I would think. At least it made them think, and like these guys said, even if it worked for a month, if it kept a kid wearing a seatbelt for 1 month, it probably saved their life at some point. And I don't know if you can just give it a blanket statement like that or not.
Right.
But again, he was never really trying to, like, you know, trying to just do it for the sake of, you know, like, I'm gonna scare the hell out of these kids with these films. You know, it wasn't like that. He wasn't doing it in a mean way. He wasn't doing it in a way to, I don't know, is salacious the right term to use in this? Like, he wasn't trying to be over the top just to be over the top to get notoriety for himself.
Right.
His when I say these were true and honest films, he really did want people to be safer behind the wheel. And I think he had a strong interest in keeping teens safe, and this was his way about, you know, going about it.
Yes. Richard Wayman is a complex and, I believe, well-intentioned figure. And the Highway Safety Foundation, again, the big question that we are grappling with and you may be grappling with, too, especially if you had to sit through these movies when you were 12, is the following. Did these save lives? Does the end justify the means? Because this topic is so fascinating that we are going to continue in a third episode, which we rarely do.
We have done this one other time, mm-hmm. and that was with Preston Tucker.
Yes. So this is a rare moment in Car Stuff history. We're going to have to take it to episode 3 because, although we've talked about the origin and the society and the growth of this, the Highway Safety Foundation was far from perfect.
Yeah, there's a lot of dirty little secrets in the past. And the thing is, some of those dirty little secrets weren't really dirty little secrets. I mean, there's scandal where there shouldn't have been scandal. And
yes.
Then, of course, there is some scandal that, you know, was truly scandal. But, there's some other twists and turns that there's no way we can get to them today unless we make this a 2-hour podcast. So, we rarely do this, but, we do have to come back for part 3.
So if you would like to hear some of the dirty laundry, the secret skeletons in the closet of the Highway Safety Foundation and the alleged skeletons in the closet, then join us in our next and final episode in our series on public safety films. In the meantime, write to us. Let us know what you think. We've been getting some fantastic listener mail about this. We might read some on the air when we come back. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can email us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.